Everyone, welcome back to the Time Shifters podcast. You're back in studio with Christopher and Matt. Matt, welcome back.
Hey.
We've had an exciting couple of weeks. We got a lot of news and stuff to talk about again. I think this is going to be another news-heavy episode with maybe just... And we watched a movie.
Which is fine.
Which is fine. It actually worked out really well last time. And actually, I need to talk a little bit more about the movie we talked about last time before we start talking about the movie for this week.
Okay.
Before we get into any of that, and before we get into the news, I just want to thank everybody for tuning in and listening, and just remind everybody that you can subscribe to the podcast, if you haven't already, by going to Apple Podcasts, Stitcher Radio, Google Play, or just use whatever podcatcher you happen to use. You can find us there. You can send any feedback or anything our way if you send an email to timeshifterspodcast@gmail.com. You can type it out or record an MP3 or something like that. That'd be great. And you can also join our Facebook group. Just go to facebook.com and search for the Time Shifters. And like I said before, make sure you get the podcast and not the band. I haven't listened to the band. I need to look them up, find out what they play, and see if they got anything out there on YouTube or something like that, or Bandcamp or something that I can check out.
Maybe we can like contact them.
And I was just thinking
they could be like the official soundtrack of the podcast.
I'd hate to get rid of Mark Mosher's awesome music that we use. I've met him; he's an awesome guy out of Denver. But I definitely think there's room for more music in the podcast. Absolutely. I'm going to do that.
We could do like, and now the Floyd email music.
Exactly. Let's see. Twitter is another way you can reach us. Go to @timeshifterspod and @moviesatthemat. You can follow us there. I think that is about it on that front. So I tell you what, we'll take a... Well, let's see. Should we take the break first and then go into the news?
The news.
Let's do the news first. We got a lot, so we'll get into some of that. Do you want to start with kind of you want to start down and work our way up?
Yeah.
Okay.
So this was the day right after we recorded last, so it's been out there for a bit. But they have officially brought on a new writer for the Batgirl movie, replacing Joss Whedon. Christina Hodson will be writing the Batgirl movie. No mm-hmm. word on a director yet. And all I haven't heard of her. I didn't look her up yet. But all I said was the best thing about Christina Hodson, she's not Joss Whedon.
All right. Fair enough. I was going to ask you. I don't remember what the name or who was throwing her name out on Twitter or something that's... the last time we talked.
Oh,
if that was the same person. Or
it wasn't her,
this
no.
is someone completely new, somewhere out of the blue, huh?
Yes.
Excellent. The name sounds vaguely familiar, but I have no idea why.
She has a few writing credits to her name, all very recent. A movie called Shut In, and then another movie called Unforgettable. Both came out within the last couple of years. Apparently, she's also going to be the screenwriter for Birds of Prey.
Interesting.
So that makes sense. A bit for continuity in the writing. Mm-hmm. Batgirl, and then apparently she's working on the screenplay for the Transformers Bumblebee movie.
Interesting. Birds of Prey, as in like Batgirl,
as in Batgirl and
Catwoman,
Huntress.
Huntress, yeah, that's it. Yeah. Oh, okay. Interesting. I didn't realize that that was going to be a new thing. I remember the old thing. What was it back in
the show?
The 90s?
Yeah.
Like one season, which showed a lot of promise, I think, ahead of its time. If you could have put that out now on the CW there with all the other DC shows or
it'd
something.
It'd be a huge hit.
It would be an enormous hit. It was way ahead of its time. I know it's available on DVD, folks. I don't know if it's still in print or not, but maybe you can dig around eBay library. Worth checking out. You will be surprised. I think it was one of these shows that no one watched but should have been.
You know? Yeah. It was one of those things that I caught like bits and pieces of, and I remember being like, wow, I probably should have watched this when it was out. And when I posted that article about her getting the job, my friend Andy goes, I'm going to remain hopeful despite what they did to Barbara's characterization in The Killing Joke. I'm still pissed about that scene. You know the one, DC. Do better.
Okay.
So I don't know if you've read The Killing Joke.
I never have. I mean, so, it's one of those things I've always heard about, so I'm not sure. I just want to make sure it's the right thing that I've heard about.
Right. So in a nutshell, it's a story about how Joker's trying to prove any good man could become like him, and so he decides, I'm going to do it to James Gordon. And Joker doesn't seem to know that Barbara Gordon is Batgirl, so he shows up at their house, shoots Barbara clear into her stomach, comes right out
okay.
her back,
so that's what I was thinking of.
Paralyzes her, but it's not just to shoot her. He then, they don't show it completely, but he then strips her naked, takes pictures of her. She's bleeding out on the floor, and then torments them with her, to Gordon later.
Oh.
And so...
Weird, I haven't heard that part of it.
And that's how she ends up in the wheelchair. Mm-hmm. And so this was all about the story between Joker and Batman. And so everybody goes, so why do we have to make a woman suffer and get humiliated on that level mm-hmm. for his arc?
Right.
And so that's what people want avoided in the future.
Gotcha.
People want her to be Oracle, but she doesn't... Get her there on her terms.
Right.
Maybe something that she does in a sacrificial way. Like she knows she's about to take a bullet for somebody as Batgirl or mm-hmm. as whatever. Don't just have her be a victim that's right. humiliated.
No, absolutely. Okay, no, absolutely. Yeah, the Birds of Prey TV show actually takes place after she's wounded.
Right.
And that adds another real interesting level in right. that show. Yeah, I didn't know about the... The extreme victimization that takes place, that is one of the things I guess people tend to just gloss over or not talk about. They yep. just talk about when she gets paralyzed, shot by the Joker and paralyzed, and
right.
don't go any further than that.
Because it's kind of an ugly topic.
Extremely, yeah. All right, yeah, no, definitely need to avoid that. And yeah, just make her a hero, not a victim, is I guess
Yeah,
what we would like to see.
Because I like her character more as Oracle. I think Oracle can reach out to more heroes. I think it's great to see a superhero who is, you know, a disabled person mm-hmm. Or a person with a disability to have that representation, you know. And I think Barbara Gordon's brain is her biggest weapon. And, you know, when they in the comic books, they've recently healed her and made her Batgirl again. I'm like, that's kind of a step back for the character. She's wasted in the field. Get right. her back behind the computer and solving all of these problems rather than like one problem.
You could use her as the anchor to all the other characters in the DC universe.
Yeah, which
they
she
can
was.
All rely on her to get the information, to get what they... I mean, that would be pretty awesome. Can you imagine she would show up in, like, every DC film in some way or another, just...
She could be the recruiter.
Yeah.
She could be like, you know what? I've been following... Like, just this message pops up. Just be like, we need to talk. It's like,
oh.
Who is this?
Yeah, wouldn't that have been more pretty neat instead of having Bruce Wayne going around recruiting everybody?
Right. You just get this. Because there was always this symbol for Oracle. It was like this green face with like a mask on it. And, you know, that's how she would appear on your computer screen. And, you know, because in the comic books, she was a member of the Justice League at one point, and only Batman knew who she really was or that Oracle was even a she, because she spoke through like a mask, you know, like one of those voice
modification,
thing.
Yeah. Right.
And so there was like this running joke of like there's a bet as to like whether or not Oracle is a man or a woman, and Batman was the only person that wouldn't jump nice. In on the bet.
That would have actually been really cool. I'm just going back to Justice League again. Even Batman knows, and now he knows that she's been reaching out, and he doesn't. He's like, I can take care of it. I can handle this myself. You know,
right.
Change it that way, you know. But she's like, no, you need these people's help, and
right.
starts reaching out to these people in this clandestine way or whatever.
Right.
And they all have to meet, and Batman doesn't even want to do this.
Yeah. Like,
that would be – that's more Batman for one thing.
Exactly. Than being like, I need friends.
Yeah. No, he needs to be told he needs help.
Exactly.
I love it. Or actually what she would be able to would do is like, well, they're going to need your help. You
yeah.
have to turn it that way. A little bit like they did in the animated series. The whole
uh-huh.
the whole point that it was Superman that really kind of got everybody together. And Batman's like, I'm not much of a team player. But if you need help, and you will.
I love that line.
Call me.
Yes.
Fantastic.
We've already written a better Justice League.
Yes, we have. Why don't they call?
I'm here.
All right, so what else do you got there?
All right, let's move over to some sad news.
Yeah, when I said start down and work up, I
didn't mean it this way.
Yeah, that seemed like that was the highlight for you.
there were a lot of deaths these last couple of weeks.
There were.
So I'm going to apologize in case I mispronounce any names. I'm always bad at that. But filmmaker Milo Forman died at the age of 86. Director best known for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Amadeus, Hair, The People vs. Larry Flint, and The Man on the Moon.
Yeah, amazing collection of work.
Yeah. and very different.
Yeah, very. Yeah, absolutely.
You wouldn't look at, like, I didn't know those movies had the same director.
Right.
Very one of those, like, kind of flew under the radar type directors, because when I heard, like, oh, legendary filmmaker, I was like, I haven't heard of it. Oh, I've heard of all of those, though.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, you didn't know his name, but you knew his work.
Yeah.
So, yeah, pretty much anybody, in, regardless of what kind of film you like, he's got a film that would fit into that genre. Yeah. Amazing. It's one of these things, again, it's always sad when we lose somebody with such talent, but he had a good life. 86 is not, you know, a bad run.
No.
And he leaves so much behind, you know, that, you know, he'll live on in his work. And it's the kind of, that's the kind of work that isn't going to be forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the films that are going to be preserved. Those are the ones that are going to show up in the Library of Congress and made sure that they aren't lost.
One of those directors that you can easily see people get into movies and acting and directing and or anything because of that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The other person who died in the last couple of weeks, Arlie Ermey, probably best known for his role as the drill sergeant in Full Metal Jacket.
Mm-hmm.
That was, I think that was the first movie I saw him in.
I think that was probably one of his, was that his first movie that he did? Or
definitely his breakout role.
Yeah. Well, he was an actual drill sergeant.
Right.
And I think he was brought on as like almost like a consultant or whatever. And then they just, you know what, you do it.
Yeah.
It was something along those lines.
Yep.
I don't know if it was for that film or it was a different film, but that's where it kind of, how it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And he just became incredibly famous being Ermey.
Yeah, being himself. Yeah. Even though he was this very kind, genuine man, like, he was one of those people that you could see, he was like, oh yeah, when I'm a drill sergeant, I'm the drill sergeant.
Right.
But then I'm me.
Mm-hmm.
And two different personalities in a way. And he's played a drill sergeant in a number of things. But then I've also seen him play it like in comedies where he's playing that same role, but then everything around him is kind of weird.
Right.
Almost in that like Naked Gun kind of
right.
thinking. Definitely a very talented person.
Yeah, he's one of those, it's one of those actors where you just kind of, when he shows up in a film, you kind of perk up.
Yes,
yeah,
exactly. Kind of, you're like,
okay. Oh, it's that guy.
Yeah.
He's going to yell. And he's going to insult. I think that was another thing, too, like all his insults, like in Full Metal Jacket, when he was a drill sergeant, all his insults and everything, ad-lib. He ad-libbed most of his stuff. I mean, it was just him being the drill sergeant. So that made him genuine. I think that's what makes a character and an actor sort of last when it's that kind of a role. Or yes, it's sort of the same thing every time, but it's a genuineness about them that people kind of just like it anyway.
Yeah.
And enjoy it when he shows up to do it.
Makes you wonder how the actors kept straight faces as he's just walking by saying the most
acting
horrible, right? I mean, I would have been like, I need things in my ears. I need to just pinch myself. I need or stab myself with like a pin or something.
Well, you know, it'd be funny if they did start to break a smile or something.
That's when he yelled at him.
He would just keep yelling at him. You think I'm funny?
Probably is what happened. I bet there was like a lot of emotional scarring when that movie was done.
I'm sure.
It's Kubrick, so we wouldn't doubt it.
Yeah. About the same time that he passed away, Harry Anderson passed away. He was most known for his role on Night Court as Judge Harry Stone. He kind of made his debut as Harry the Hat on Cheers. He would show up occasionally on Cheers. He was an actor and a magician and just all-around fun guy from what I can gather. You know, he was fairly quiet once he kind of the Night Court thing was done. He kind of just faded a little bit. He would show up every now and again. It, you know, I never got the feeling like he was out there banging on doors and no one was answering. I think he was just, he enjoyed a little bit of his privacy and just doing what he enjoyed doing. He ran apparently a magic shop down in New Orleans.
Oh, wow.
For a while. Just an absolute fun guy. I grew up watching Night Court, and, you know, a great deal of my sense of humor probably came from him, from his character. So it was an absolute sad. He was only 65 when he passed away, which is way too young. I'm sure there was more that he could have offered us, and that was a big, kind of a hard one for me. It was sad.
So to change gears.
Oh, actually, before we go, because it only just happened, I just mentioned it, Vern Troyer.
Oh, right.
Just passed away a couple days before recording here. Of course, everyone knew him as Mini-Me. I do get the feeling that he, from what I've read, you know, he had a troubled life.
Yes.
He dealt with a lot of issues with maybe drugs and alcohol and depression, I think I read too, which is unfortunate. I'm sorry that the newfound fame that he had with Mini-Me wasn't enough to kind of help pull him out of a lot of that.
Right.
It's very unfortunate. So definitely thoughts go out to him and his family and his fans. I understand people who have actually met him thought he was, and knew him thought he was a really lovely guy. Mm-hmm. He was a nice guy. So it's a shame. And it's I don't know if maybe Mini-Me hurt more than helped.
It could have.
And so, definitely a sad situation all around. But he'll be missed, I guess.
Definitely. Yeah, he always brought... I always thought it was funny that Mini-Me was pretty much mute the whole movie, mm-hmm. and he brought so much with his face and with his gestures and... Yeah, or just going, eee! Like, how are you being the funniest part of this movie and that's your only line?
Right.
Yeah. So definitely a big talent.
Mm-hmm.
Changing gears, back to movies and superheroes, Steven Spielberg being brought on to direct a DC Comics Black Hawk movie.
I'm not familiar much with the Black Hawk franchise, I guess, whatever.
So I'm not super familiar with them, but I know a little bit. They are an Air Force fighting team during World War II.
Okay, I heard more. I was familiar, at least that much. Yeah,
right up Spielberg's alley, isn't
it?
Yeah,
sure.
Just person without powers. It's just, you know, it's the World War II era. I mean, come on, it's Indiana Jones in a plane, isn't it?
That's what it sounds like.
So, I mean, he's done so many things during that time period. He's a little bit fixated on it, and good for him. His best work comes out of that.
Mm-hmm.
So is it going to be tied to the cinematic universe? Is it going to be something like, oh yeah, this team got together because, you know, there was this great woman and that fought during World War I, and, you know, we're doing it in honor of Steve Trevor? And
how cool would it be to have Wonder Woman show up?
Right. You know, you could.
Mean, you know,
you could.
And
you
fight along the Black
she's
Hawk
flying
team.
Along yeah. there, you know, because they said in Justice League that, you know, she didn't actually stop fighting. She just did it on the down low and didn't let anybody see her do it.
Mm-hmm.
So she could show up in World War II, which is when she's supposed to be around, you
right.
know. But, or is it going to be one of those standalones that they're also working on?
I could see them, if they do it wisely, if they do it smartly, they could use this to be individual by itself, but still lay a little bit of groundwork for future films.
Right.
Or retroactively lay groundwork to something that we've already seen or something like that. They could do that with this. And if they're smart about it, they can and they will. I'd like that. That would be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be a little bit like had Avengers come out before Captain America. You could still have Captain America just the way it was.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and it still would have worked. It just would have laid that little groundwork and like, oh, yeah, that's how he got frozen. Now we know, you know.
Yeah, you could do it a whole number of ways. And, you know, I still like him. I haven't seen Ready Player One. I haven't seen The Post yet. But, like, I hear those are good movies. And it's weird to say this, but it sounds like Steven Spielberg's making a comeback.
Yeah. Yeah, it may be. He's kind of like, you know, third act or something. Like
yeah,
that.
He was never really down on his luck, but you've kind of looked at his movies over the last like 10, 15 years, and you're sort of like, is that really your best, Steven? Is that all you got?
Well, and I think what I like is Spielberg certainly doesn't need to do it. He doesn't need to work.
No.
He could definitely just sit back and sit on his laurels and enjoy the rest of his life and, you know, call it retirement if he wants. So the fact that he's coming back and doing this stuff, it means he's got an urge, you know.
Yeah.
This is something he wants to do. He's a director and he wants to direct. So even if he doesn't come up with the best of things or whatever, I still appreciate him for, I guess, having that drive to keep doing what he's doing.
How great would it be if, like, the DC Universe gets turned around on Steven Spielberg's World War II movie?
I would love it. That would be fantastic. But that's going to be I could see this could either be okay or set a bar really high.
Right.
And
similar to how Wonder Woman did.
Yeah, a little bit.
Just keep everything in the past, guys. Just do Justice Society. Forget the League.
Exactly.
So I got involved in something on Twitter that trended for a few days, actually. Filmstruck tweeted out, we want to celebrate personal nature of cinema. and fill your timeline with the films that define you.
Mm-hmm.
Pick four films and then tag four friends to do the same. Hashtag filmstruck4. So I jumped in on this immediately. I didn't wait for anybody to tag me because I didn't think it would come my way. But I went and thought about this not as my top four movies, but four movies that I could think of that define me as someone who loves movies and what it says about me. So the four I picked were Back to the Future, 12 Angry Men, The Iron Giant, and Whiplash.
That last one definitely I found interesting. Because Whiplash is actually a film I didn't enjoy whatsoever.
No.
No, I didn't like it. Great acting, I'll admit it. But as far as the story goes and everything, I was like, so the moral of the story is be an asshole and people will want to please you.
Yeah.
So is that the true you?
It's that idea of going somewhere dark. It's that idea of maybe going outside of who you are to achieve something. I'm not necessarily saying that's who I am, but I understand that level of thinking. I've been in that place where it's just sort of like, where did I just go with my thoughts right there? Like, where did I let that take me? And so I understand that breaking the comfort zone and just throwing all caution to the wind and just saying, hell with it. Let's see what happens.
So did you mull over, or was it something that you came up with pretty quick when you thought your four movies?
Pretty quick. Like, I typed them out, and I deleted a few, and then I put some others in, and it kept going back and forth. And, like, I thought, like, should I throw in Mask of the Phantasm? Like, no, Iron Giant, because Iron Giant is so much more optimistic, and mm-hmm. it ends on such a better note, and I still cry at the end of that movie. Not afraid to admit it. When he's flying up, and he smiles and says, Superman, and I'm like, oh, God.
It's been too long since I've seen it, and I think I've avoided it just for that reason.
No, so you gotta
need
see
more
it.
Reasons to cry in movies.
It just got put back onto Netflix, and I have it on my queue. I need to see it before they take it off.
Yeah, absolutely.
I need to go out and get it on Blu-ray. Damn it! That's
yeah,
what I
that's
need
definitely
to do.
One that needs to be like in your home library.
I think that's one of the last great traditionally animated movies
that's
been
true.
Made.
It was traditional cell animation,
yeah.
Wasn't it?
Yeah. So good. Like, the part where, like, he full-on becomes a weapon and you see all the different things that he is, you're just sort of like, you know, like, somebody just sat in a room for, like, 2 weeks and just thought, oh, what else could he do? Like, there's the part where, like, this thing starts spinning and then this needle hits it and it's just all the sparks that fly off, but those are big enough sparks that they're just dead. Like, who thought of that? Who thought of a skipping needle on metal to fire sparks off would be a weapon and then animated it?
Now, when I came up with my list, I admit, I mulled over it for several days, you know, from the time you typed me to the time I actually finally replied to it. I kind of thought about it, and I thought about it, and thought about it. And then in the end, I wrote down four films real quick and tweeted it. And then I looked at it, and I'm like, you know, that actually, there's no other movies I could have picked that I think define me better. My films were Ghostbusters.
Sure.
I picked Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country.
Okay.
I threw in, I already forgot which ones I picked now.
Godzilla.
Oh, Godzilla, of course.
So the original.
I went in and just went with Godzilla.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll go original. It's kind of one of these things that it's Godzilla almost in its entirety.
1999's Godzilla. God, no.
And then Plan 9 from Outer Space.
That's the one that got me. So I was like, okay.
But if you look at those films, and if you know me, it's like, yes, that makes perfect sense.
And it does.
It really does. I mean, Ghostbusters is just, Ghostbusters is Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
And that film, I think just the fact my love for it kind of helps define me. But there's also in that film, you know, regardless of whether you think it's a comedy or a science fiction or whatever, the movie is about people doing what they love, living their lives, but they're finding humor mm-hmm. throughout the thing. And I think that's very important. I go through my day and, you know, if I can't find something to laugh at, or even if it's me, you know, then my day's not complete. So I think there's a lot of that in there. Star Trek VI, I think, is probably the best example of what Star Trek really stands for. It, you know, the hope, the unification of people that don't get along, but trying to find common ground is a driving theme in that. It's you know, uplifting, and I think it helps define Star Trek, or it itself defines Star Trek better than a lot of the other films do, at least what it means to me. Godzilla is just because it's Godzilla. I mean, people that know me know I love Godzilla. So one kind of blends into the other. And then, yes, Plan 9 from Outer Space. And I do love the cheese. I love some of the bad films. What I love most about Plan 9 and Ed Wood Jr. films is that, no, he wasn't a great filmmaker, but damn it, he loved doing what he did.
Yeah.
And he poured his heart and soul in those films. Everyone that worked on those films did, you know, and it's where a lot of my love for like the independent film comes from, is that everyone that works on it, no one's trying to make crap.
Right.
Sometimes it doesn't work, and that's what you get. But no one's trying to make a bad film. And the people that do try to make bad films because they think it's ironic and funny, I don't like them. I don't find them humorous. I don't think they're funny. I don't think they're clever. Try to make a good film. Try to do what you can to make a good film. And if it doesn't work, well, it's okay. You learn, and you make the next film. And, you know, Ed Wood films are a really great example of that. Everyone there is working, trying to do their best with what they have. And, you know, and you know what? I'll defend that film. It's an enjoyable as all hell to watch, I think. Especially if you get the colorized version. I got it on Blu-ray colorized. It's a lot of fun. So those films, it was so funny that I just kind of like, what am I going to pick? What am I going to pick? I'll pick this. Wow, that actually really worked.
Plan 9 was one of those movies that you could see the enthusiasm that was taking place, just how it was shot and how the actors were like, oh yeah, so what if the tombstone flipped over? Cut, keep going.
Yep, just keep going. Yeah, it's all right. And I feel that a lot of the way with a lot of the Ed Wood films that he's doing, and there's films where the guy walks through the door and hits the door, the whole wall shake. They make fun of it. They point it out in the Ed Wood movie. And you kind of imagine that's how it might have happened. You know, guy his size would always have trouble going through doors. Just keep going. So, I like the discussion that kind of got sparked on your Twitter feed with that, is there was a lot of different ways people were taking it. There's a lot of people that were just trying to, who just were throughout the first four films that kind of came to mind, and others that were, these are my films now. Ask me again 5 minutes from now, and I'll have another four.
Yeah.
And there's others that'll just mull over it for days before putting something up at all, and then still have that until tomorrow, you know, kind of thing. It was an interesting exercise.
Yeah, I think I could pick like almost any four movies and still feel like, well, that's not defining me any better or any worse. So it's one of those things that you could drive yourself crazy over, but just throw some four movies out that you love and that say something about you.
Yep.
And I do have to say, for everybody listening, Christopher is wearing a Ghostbusters t-shirt right now.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I am, yeah. So, yeah, the Twitters are still up there, and I did bring it over onto the Facebook group as well to try to get some responses on my own personal page, and I got a few responses from a few different people. They have some interesting choices, but unfortunately, you know, they're not here to really kind of
explain why,
what about those films really make them, but it's still fun to see. There's quite an eclectic mix of films usually when people put up their four.
Yeah, very much. I mean, I feel like my four films like don't really have much to do with each other, but for me, they work. That's what they have in common. I love them. And so my last bit of news, and I think this is pretty cool, Saudi Arabia is ending its 35-year ban in movie theaters with a screening of Black Panther.
It's interesting.
Last year, or it was like right end of last year, beginning of this year, because we were confused. We thought we heard that they had ended that ban with the Emoji movie, but it turns out that the Emoji movie was being screened in Saudi Arabia at a film festival. So that's where it was like movies in general,
right. The
ban was lifted, and now it's the ban on movie theaters. So this will be the first movie shown in theaters in Saudi Arabia. I think that's amazing.
It is amazing, but there is a part of me that looks at that and go, is it because there's that sort of, I hate to use the term anti-white, pro-black message versus the, you know,
I know what you're saying.
Discuss this without really trying to get into a pretty heavy debate or
whatever.
But that is in the Black Panther. There's sort of a, you could almost call it an anti-Western sort of.
I think that's a better way to look at it. Yeah, I would agree with that if the other movies that were at the film festival weren't The Emoji Movie and Captain Underpants, which is a big blobus white guy running around in his tidy whiteies. That's about as Western and white as you get.
Yeah, maybe. Depends on how you dub it.
There's no way to unmute that movie. It's still as Western and white as you get. You know, because there was this debate I heard on another podcast where they were talking about The Emoji Movie, and they were saying, like, that's the first movie in 35 years. They're never going to go back to the movies again.
Yeah.
So what is the worst movie you would show to people, but now you have to defend it to say, no, this is why movies are good. And then they just had like a whole 30-minute conversation about the worst movies they could think of, but would still defend it. So I look at it as you put something like Black Panther in there because, you know what, maybe they don't need another message from the white Western world. Maybe they can see something that speaks more to them and what they're going through. I think that's why Black Panther is as popular as it is. It speaks to so many people outside of white culture. And so I think that's a perfect movie to start with to lift a ban on theaters in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is probably the better way to look at it. I immediately went to like the negative side of that
coin.
That's
fine.
But I think that the positive side is definitely the best way to look at it. Yeah. And hopefully movies have messages, and the messages can spread, you know. And
Does that movie have one.
we shall see what happens. I'm curious to see if this is a one-shot or if other films – you know, find their way.
I got to imagine if they're lifting their ban, like how many theaters needed to be like just even cleaned up, like because were they abandoned? Were they used for like stage plays? Were they used for music? Either way, you got to get a projector in there. You've got to get a good screen
That's
in there.
That's what I was wondering. I wonder if the number of theaters that actually showed this was relying on just how many could get the projector working again.
Right. Yeah. So, but even that's going to take time and money. So unless they did it on the cheapest thing they could think of, you're probably going to bring some more in, and I'm sure it'll grow.
Yeah.
Infinity War's coming out. They got to know what happens next.
Yeah, no kidding.
And I'm sure there's been a lot of like pirating movies that have gone around.
Oh, yeah.
So they probably want to see this on the big screen, and they're probably going to be like, we want to see the next one.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure this isn't the first film that they've seen in Saudi Arabia.
No.
I mean, I'm sure the home video market in Saudi Arabia, whether it's out in the open or underground, is probably huge.
Yeah.
Keeping on the theme of theaters, this came up that Netflix is apparently looking to try to buy theater chains.
Yeah.
So what do you think of this? I mean, right now they're saying that they can't, they're making original content. They're not just making original shows, they're making original films, and they can only show them on Netflix right now.
Right.
Now so, they're looking like they want to be able to actually take these and show them in theaters, which then would open them up to all the awards and accolades and everything that all the other current film studios enjoy.
Well, they could show them in theaters. They have that option. They would just then have to like pay for distribution and all that. I don't think this was a plan. I think this was a reaction because last year, no, 2 years ago at the Cannes Film Festival, they debuted their movie. I don't know how to pronounce it. I think it's Okja. It's about like that big creature that this girl has. And it's like this big gentle giant kind of story. And it got a lot of rave reviews. And I haven't watched it yet. But, you know, it debuted at Cannes and then it did really well. I don't think it won anything. I could be wrong about that. But then Netflix turned around and said, all right, it's available on Netflix. And they were like, you're not going to put it in our theaters here in France? And they were like, no.
Hmm.
And they were really insulted by that. Like, so we have it here. We're showcasing it here. We're reviewing it and we're raving about it. And you're not going to put it in our theaters. No, we're not. Last year, Cannes comes out with a rule. No movie can be shown here unless it is in a theater in France or plans to be.
Interesting.
And so now this year, Netflix says, we're looking to buy some movie theaters.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder why.
Yeah. Interesting. It'll be interesting to see how it all plays out. I think in the end, they will. I mean, I think this particular deal fell through. But I think in the end they will find a chain, whether, you know, and it's just a matter of how many theaters, and eventually the deal will work. We will have Netflix movie theaters.
And I wonder how it will work, because I could see this being one of the things that kind of helps save the movie theater, because if they do it right, if they say, all right, our movie's coming out just at these few theaters, and it's only going to be out for a month, and then you're going to have to wait like 3-4 months until it comes to Netflix, rather than waiting for like the DVD release, the Netflix release. So if you want to see it before everybody else, run to the theater, because imagine if you told everybody you only got 30 days to see this on the big screen. Everyone's going to flood to that theater for those 30 days, knowing that they'll have to wait several months to see it at home.
I wonder if it'll also bring on a little bit more like the Alamo Draft House and a lot of the other theaters are doing now too, and maybe it's just a matter of getting the proper distribution rights or whatever about bringing, you know, older films to the theaters again for revivals or anniversaries or just because or whatever. If they would kind of, it seems to be pretty popular right now. There's a lot of small, you know, privately owned theaters or whatever are doing it. They're showing Casablanca or whatever. Wouldn't that be nice to be able to actually see that on a marquee of a major theater chain?
Definitely.
That just on Friday night, whatever, we're going to show. Oh, you know, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest because so-and-so and you know, Remembrance or something like that. That would be pretty awesome. And if it's something that's in the Netflix library, would that allow them to do that? Or would there be other legal ramifications that they'd have to, you know, hurdles that they would have to jump in order to do that?
You could take this to the point of like, hey, can I rent the theater for the day and pull up my queue? You're just flipping through like, yes, that one. Took me 45 minutes to find what I wanted to watch.
You and your friends, you rent a theater, right. you just go start going through your queue. What do you guys feel up to today?
Right. Oh, we just spent our whole 2 hours. We didn't pick anything.
Ate lots of great popcorn, though. Or not great popcorn, depending on your point of view. I think it's great. Last little thing. I think that was that the last thing, the only thing?
Okay. We've caught up on the news.
Yeah. The last thing I wanted to mention, it was something that came up just fairly recently. The director of Fast and the Furious, what's his name? F. Gary Gray, has been picked to helm a live-action film based on the 80s children's cartoon Mask, M-A-S-K, the Mobile Armored Strike Command, with a K, in the 80s, you could do that, was about a, you know, like a crime-fighting force that drove what looked like standard automobiles but would transform into battle machines.
Ah, the 80s.
Yes. Yes, on the heel of Transformers and stuff, I'm sure.
It's like, we're going to take Transformers and G.I. Joe and make them one thing.
It's exactly what the mask is.
That's the 80s.
Absolutely what the mask is. Of course, the enemy that they fought was Venom, vicious, evil network of mayhem.
My God.
No telling how much of this will carry through to the actual live film.
All or none of it.
That's how I feel,
you
honestly.
You gotta just go full on, let's just camp the hell out of this.
I have to admit, I'm excited at the idea of seeing the, you know, the transforming car thing. You know, the Transformers, I think they missed the mark by making them too complicated to the point where they just do, it's a blur and suddenly they're a robot, blur, and they're a car. And, you know, like, well, how did that become, you know,
50 feet taller than the car could ever be?
Yeah, exactly. And I would love to see them do it a little bit more simpler. Where in Mask, it was a simple, you know, the car turns into a gall wing. The gall wings are the wings. And, you know, jets shoot out the exhaust. I'm like, just keep it simple and make it fun. Please. Don't overcomplicate it. Just make it campy. Make it fun. And I think it would be an absolute blast. And Lynn, please just bring it on. There's a lot of 80s cartoons that I would love to see live action film versions of.
And that's kind of what like the Fast and the Furious was. It was this, you know, goofy, campy, you know, like you're not supposed to take any of this seriously what they're doing. Maybe in the first movie, like what they were doing was a bit more grounded. But since then, the stuff those cars have done.
Yeah.
Nah.
So maybe they picked the exact right person to helm this project. So fingers crossed, we'll see what happens. We'll see how it, which way it goes. All right, yes, we've caught up on the news a little bit, so we will go ahead and take that break. We'll listen to a promo for another podcast. And when we get back, we're going to discuss a little bit about planes, trains, and automobiles.
Tuning into Sci-Fi TV.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. I'm Brent Barrett.
I'm Kevin Batchelder.
I'm Wendy Hembrock.
The Viewer's Guide to Genre Television.
Welcome, everyone, to a special supernatural-focused bonus
Hello, everyone,
show.
And welcome to The Fae Files,
a family of podcasts for the genre-loving television viewer.
Welcome to Saturday B Movie Reel.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the study
welcome
group.
Welcome to the top genre characters of all time countdown.
And tonight, we're going to be talking about Game of Thrones Season 3.
Find us at tuningintosci-fi-tv.com.
All right, this is the film that came up a couple times. People suggested as being one of their favorite films. It was a film that I thought definitely had to be one that we discussed. Turns out it was came out the same year as Throw Mama from a Train.
That's funny.
So I thought that was would make it interesting because I really remembered enjoying this film, and I didn't really care for Throw Mama from a Train. I thought it was okay. It was fine. It was good. So it'd be okay. Same year, you know, just kind of different style of film. Let's see what the differences are. Before we get into it, you know, one of the things we didn't mention at all from Throw Mama from the Train, and maybe it would have changed my opinion, it does maybe slightly, Dane DeVito directed. It was his directorial debut.
Oh, you didn't know that? I thought...
I didn't know that. We didn't mention it.
I thought I did.
I don't think it came up once, or if it did, I completely missed it. Good on him. I mean, that was a...
Yeah.
Quite the task to take on, and he did a great job, and that might explain a little bit why it felt like a sitcom to me, because... What at the time did Danny DeVito have the most experience in?
Right. He's got years worth of Taxi under his belt.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, maybe that changes my opinion slightly. It makes me appreciate a little bit more, maybe.
For a first movie, plus he's got to be in half the scenes.
Exactly. And it does explain why, okay, I want to be different than I've been in everything else. And how better way to do that than, you know... It's no one else's. You're not meeting anyone else's expectations. You're
right.
The director. You can do whatever you want.
Now think he's directing himself in that scene talking about the coins.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah, very good. Absolutely. So anyway, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. This one's a John Hughes film.
That gives it a leg up immediately.
Yes.
John Hughes' films are kind of like, they're all under like this same filter, but you still don't realize that they're all John Hughes films until you look them up. You're like, why does this feel... It's John Hughes, that's why. Okay.
Yeah, that was something that, you know, Planes... Or Throw Mama from a Train could exist in a couple different decades.
Yep.
Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is so solidly in the 80s.
Yep.
Mainly, I think, because of the soundtrack.
Yes.
Yeah. If there was anything that I would really say kind of dings the film, it's the soundtrack. But what did you think of this film? You had not seen Planes, Trains, and Automobiles before.
This has been on my list for a long time, probably since like high school.
And I haven't watched it, I'm going to go ahead and say 15, 20 years.
Okay.
So this was almost a first time watch. It's kind of one of these things I knew I watched it and I remembered it being funny, rewatching it again to see if it did it hold up to my memory.
Did it?
Yes.
Okay.
Actually, it did. I don't know what it is, why this one is so much different than Throw Mama from a Train, but this one's laugh out loud funny for me at points.
I would probably say that's because Billy Crystal and Danny DeVito are two phenomenal actors, very funny people, but this is Steve Martin and John Candy, two geniuses at the height of their game.
Yes.
So that's why. Written and directed by John Hughes.
This was just a step up. Thrill Moment from a Train, I liked and found some bits funny. This film I thought was funny and found some bits hilarious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really liked it. Didn't laugh out loud that much. Did have a few moments where I was like, hey. More like that, or just sort of smiled. But there was one moment where I had like a solid reaction to, and that's when he accidentally backs the car into the hotel.
Really?
I covered my mouth. I was like, oh, God. Like, you don't see that coming. Like, all right, they're going to rock. I'm thinking, like, Steve Martin's going to fall down or his foot's going to get run up. No, we're going to destroy that hotel room. I was like, oh, dear God.
I think the scene that I sat in that very chair and just, I was like, I was like a little kid and spinning in it, just laughing, is the on the highway when John Candy gets himself trapped with his parka and he can't steer the car, and they go off the road and they end up going the wrong way on the highway, and then they go in between those two trucks
and just and you scrape see along
him,
the side.
Suddenly you see them both as skulls.
Yeah.
They're screaming. Steve Martin looks over at John Candy.
He's the devil.
And he looks like he's a laughing devil with the flames and the sparks going along his side.
Cheapest devil costume ever purchased.
And then they finally stop, and they have to literally peel their hands out of the dash and the steering wheel. I'm laughing about it now. I thought that is an hilarious scene.
Is that the scene Floyd wrote in about?
The scene that Floyd actually thought was really funny was the first hotel room, where they wake up and they're spooning, and John Candy's kissing Steve Martin's ear. That final line, where's your other hand? Between two pillows.
Those aren't pillows.
That was the scene that Floyd was mentioning.
Okay. I liked it and I was entertained by it. Didn't laugh too much, but did have reactions to it. So I thought it was good. The thing that I started noticing pretty early on, and I started like researching, like, did anybody else like make this comparison? And I couldn't find anyone who did. I am 100% convinced that John Candy's character of Del Griffith was the sole inspiration for Peter Griffin on Family Guy.
I wouldn't be surprised at all.
Because there's a part where right when they're on the plane and he won't stop talking and he's just like, oh, yeah.
You know what grinds my gears?
Yes! And I was like, oh, my God, he's Peter Griffin! What the hell? And so I went looking for it and I was like, somebody else has had to have made this connection. Can't find it. And I started like, hi, Boris. There's no editing that out.
Nope.
And just to see, like, you know, did anyone else make this connection? I couldn't find anyone that did, but there's a scene from Family Guy where they're waiting at like a train station and Peter walks out and Lois is like, did you get the tickets? And he's like, no, but I did buy these shower rings from some guy that was selling them. This one's filled with helium, so it's lighter. And I'm like, all right, I don't get it, but I think I'm gonna. Like, because I stopped at the plane scene, and I was like, I got to find out if this is true or not. No one seems to have made this connection.
And that's a Family Guy definitely has made the connection.
Right. He's him. He looks like him. He acts like him. He doesn't shut up like him. He's a dope like him. Grinds my gears. I was like, that is straight from this movie.
First thing I thought of when I saw that, too.
It was ridiculous. But that scene with the driving, because throughout the whole movie, I'm thinking, like, Del is kind of like this lovable dope. Mm-hmm. You know, he doesn't mean to do what he's doing. He's not an idiot. But then he gets his hand stuck with his parka. And all I can think of, no, he is an idiot, because all he has to do is hit the brakes.
Yeah.
That's it. I get it. You lose the joke, but you've just gone from, he's just kind of a bumbling, you know, means well, annoying guy, to he's a moron.
Yeah.
Hit the brakes, dude.
Yeah, just stop the car and undo yourself.
Right. You went from just kind of annoying to dumb and dumber in that scene.
Yeah. A little bit there. It may be, you know, is that inconsistency or is that what they, I mean, it was obviously done for the humor, for the joke. But yeah, maybe a little bit over the top there where you build up this guy as just being this well-meaning but goofy you know,
gets on your nerves.
Gets on your nerves a little bit.
To full on stupid.
Exactly. Yeah. How'd you like all the cameos?
The cameos were great. I made a list. Yeah. You've got Dylan Baker as Owen. It's his first movie. You've got Eddie McClurg as the rental car agent.
Edie McClurg, yeah.
I was sitting there wondering, like, why is this movie rated R? Like, nothing's happened. And then they get
one minute of that
60
film.
Seconds, and he drops 18 F-bombs. And then she fires one back, and I'm like,
That's why I get
the rated R now. And then it never does that again. Like, this would have been a solid, for the 80s, PG movie.
Oh, sure. PG-13 by today's standards, except for that 1 minute. You excise that 1 minute out.
And it makes me wonder, how did he sell that to the studio? Like, he must have screened this for the executives, and they probably just thought, it's funny, we're not cutting that. That's too funny. Because otherwise, like, how do you tell an executive, oh, we're going to make this a rated R movie because of 1 minute?
Take it with a grain of salt, you know, as you, whatever, it's on the internet, but supposedly, this is like IMDb's, you know, trivia or something, that scene was one of the scenes that really got Steve Martin interested in the script.
Yeah, so I heard that too.
Maybe that's one of those things that you can't cut the scene that got you your biggest star to sign on.
I can see an exec being like, watch me. Oh, you're Steve Martin. I'm so-and-so, you know, whatever.
I'm the one that signs a check.
Right. And then Michael McKean as the state trooper.
Did you miss Kevin Bacon?
Oh, that's right, at the beginning. Yeah. And I kept thinking, like, he's a star at this point. What's he doing?
Is all just because it's a John Hughes film.
That's true.
And it's, you know, these are films that, you know, John Hughes worked with a lot of these people, and it's just, hey,
He'll do anything for him.
You want to do this? Come over and just do this quick scene, and we'll call it. We'll make it look like you're that one film you're in, but you're running instead of bicycling. We're talking about like they did it as kind of a nod to Bacon's Quicksilver when he was a bicycle messenger or something like that, and. I don't know if all that is true or not, or if that's people armchair quarterbacking it down the road. But
I was making a joke to myself, like, Steve Martin, you're not going to outrace him. He's footloose. The other thing that it kept reminding me of, this is another comedy I forgot to mention, one of my favorites. It reminded me a little bit of The Out-of-Towners.
Okay. I don't think...
Do you know that movie?
I'm trying to remember.
It's a Neil Simon comedy. Jack Lemmon. He's him and his wife are moving from like the suburb, or thinking of moving from like the suburbs in like Minneapolis to like the big city, to New York, because he's got a job interview, and it's just one of those things, like, and everything goes wrong, and it's all about getting to the job interview. Like, they're supposed to fly in. There's a bad storm. We're gonna have to land somewhere else, and then, you know, you're gonna have to figure out how, you know, like, hey, the hotel will save our reservation. I don't have to call ahead. Surely they'll save it. They didn't save his reservation. You can sleep in the lobby. I'm not going to sleep in the lobby. I'm going to go somewhere else. They get mugged. Then they call the police, and then the police pick them up, but then there's like a murder happening somewhere, so the police have to drop them. They have to walk across Central Park in the middle of the night. They have to sleep in the park. They get robbed again. All these things go wrong. And I kept thinking, like, that's like a movie trope that, like, pops up a lot, you know. Things just keep getting worse, but it's always the character's fault. And in The Out-of-Towners, it's very much Jack Lemmon's fault. Like, if he was just patient, or if he just sat in the hotel, things would have worked out fine. This movie, none of it is his fault.
The only thing you could say is, if he had chosen to just sleep in the airport that first night, maybe he could have gotten a flight out.
Maybe.
Yeah.
But that was the argument of, like, you know, there's 18 hours that they're catching up on. I think he would have made the same decision. He wouldn't have met up with Dell,
right?
But would his situation have been any better? And it wasn't his impatience. It was just...
That's what I think I loved most about this film, is it wasn't, like you were just saying, it wasn't so much the characters, other than maybe the getting trapped in the car with his parka.
Yeah.
Nothing that these guys did...
It's completely out of their control.
Yeah, exactly. It's bad weather. They're trying. All the hotel rooms are booked. It's just situations, and it's like an exaggerated experience of things that most of us have dealt with. You know, we've had the delayed flights. We've had the bad weather, the airport closures, the you know, the car
catching fire.
Maybe, you know, the rental car in his case wasn't there, right. But how about the rental car that breaks down or something? It's happened to a lot of us.
Right.
Maybe not all at once.
Right. And I think that's what the great part is. Like, it's all out of his control, but we've all been there.
Mm-hmm.
And then I read that no airline, no train company, no rental.
They had to create their own for right. everything.
Nobody wanted to put their product in the movie because it's like, well, that's going to make us look terrible, which yep. makes sense.
Supposedly, they actually laid track
yeah.
and brought in and used old, used rail cars or whatever to create the train scene.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
Nobody wanted to sign up for it.
So what do they call it? Comtrack or something, like that?
Train go.
Yeah, Brent, I'm glad you enjoyed it. I'm sorry you didn't find it funnier than you were, at least, you know, not as funny as I did. I still thought it was hilarious.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of those movies that I just kept thinking about. So it's just one of those things where I'm not reacting, but I'm thinking to myself, that's a really funny line.
Oh,
just
gotcha.
Very straight. Like, I was analyzing the comedy. I think that's why I don't seek out comedies, because I think about them too much. But because one of the lines was when he's arguing about he's supposed to be in first class, and he's just like, well, how right. can it get any worse? And then immediately it just cuts to John Candy being like, is this a coincidence or what? And I'm just like, I love that kind of timing. That's good. Didn't laugh at it, but thought it was great.
Right. Like I said, it is definitely an 80s flick,
mm-hmm.
and so the end gets a little schmaltzy.
Yeah, which is kind of like this John Hughes staple that, like, his comedies are really about something else.
Mm-hmm.
Usually it's, like, about family, and that was this. You know, like, that's what, like, Home Alone is, that's what Uncle Buck is, and that's what this is, and it just gets to the root of it. You've been having a good laugh, but here... The man was trying to get home, and it's not supposed to just be like, I'm home, and then he collapses, and then the credits roll.
Right.
He's supposed to have that moment with his family. He finally made it to the top of the mountain.
I was referring to the fact that he realizes that the whole time Del Griffith doesn't have a family. His wife, as it turns out, has been dead for 8 years. He's been kind of just not telling the truth about, you know,
right.
that he has this wife to come go home to. He doesn't have a home. And, you know, Steve Martin... And Neil Page realizes it. And in the end, it's like, oh, and then, of course, brings him home to his house to have Thanksgiving dinner. And that's where I was like, that's where the real schmaltz kind of plays in.
They kept dropping hints here and there throughout the movie, and yet it's still not an ending that you think about. You kind of see it coming, but you're not preoccupied with it. Because I just kept remember thinking, like, in those parts that Steve Martin kept thinking back to, like, oh, I haven't been home in years. I'm like... Why?
Mm-hmm.
Why haven't you been home in years? And then he has that part where he's like talking to his wife that isn't there. And I'm like, are they divorced or is she dead? But then he backs the car into the hotel and I'm not thinking
about it.
Right.
Yeah.
So it doesn't surprise you, but you're not prepared for it, I guess is the best way to look at it. But again, I liked it because it explains the character. It explains why he's trying to be friends with so many people and why he's... You're almost thinking like he's doing all of this funny stuff to keep himself from crying in a way.
It does also explain how he could destroy a bathroom like he does. That is definitely a bachelor kind of thing. No wife would put up with that.
That scene confused me because I'm like, did Steve Martin walk in with his eyes closed?
Yeah.
Like, or did John Candy do all of that while Steve Martin was in the shower?
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
It still makes it funny because poor Steve Martin trying to dry himself with... He's the only man I know that could actually make trying to dry yourself with a hand cloth funny.
Funny. He's like flossing his back.
That was the best part. He just starts dabbing. I was like, oh, that makes sense. But yeah, then he tries to do the back thing. It's like, oh, God. That just takes it to that next level.
I would pull my shoulder trying to do that.
Absolutely, just a fun film. Still, for me, it still holds up as being hilarious. You enjoyed it. That says a lot right there. I think people would still get a big kick out of it. If they haven't seen it, they definitely need to watch it. Would you say that much?
And I would definitely say that. It's definitely like one of those like good, solid 80s comedies.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I read is apparently there's like a 3.5 hour version that was shot.
Yeah, John Hughes shot a lot of film.
Which I could see because I kept thinking, like, I feel like I should know more about the relationship between Neil and his wife. Because when he got home, she was like holding back tears that he's there. And I'm like, did we earn that? Like, I felt like something was missing. And when you realize, like, you're down to half of what was shot, that makes sense. Because I felt like that was a really emotional moment for her when really she should have been like, well, he's home. Because everyone else is like, hey, he's home.
Oh, my gosh, it's about time. What happened? Right.
Right. Because there were those moments where, like, you know, once again, she's in bed by herself. But, like, it sounds like he's traveled for work before, that she's a little bit used to this.
Right.
Is something else going on? Is this holiday, does this mean something to them?
Would have been nice to see more of her actually being worried that she hasn't heard or worried, or maybe, you know, half missed phone calls or something.
Right. It seemed like there was definitely a lot of that cut out for this version. And John Hughes went on to say that, you know, it's all shot. It's somewhere. Mm-hmm. It hasn't been edited together. It doesn't exist as a full movie. Right. But apparently there is like a 2-hour version that's never been released. Mm-hmm. I wonder if those extra 30 minutes.
Quite a few more scenes between Neil and Dell, too. Just other instances of showing how...
More jokes.
More jokes. And
what
more,
goes wrong.
A little bit more of, you know, Dell's... There was apparently a scene where... someone with long hair is in the seat on the airplane.
The food, yeah.
And he leans back and the food goes over Neil's brownie or something like
that. The
hair. Yeah, the hair. And Neil, or Dell is like, oh, you're not going to eat that? And just rifles through the hair and grabs it and eats it. So things like that. A little bit more of the odd coupleness between the two.
Yeah. In the 3-hour version, it was trains, planes, boats, and automobile.
Yeah, a helicopter, boat.
Right.
Yeah. Hovercraft.
Unicycle.
That's the only thing they missed was like having him on a tandem bike.
Right. That would have been great. You just see like Steve Martin just like huffing and puffing up a hill. And
are you working? John Candy.
Sure. And he's in the back and he's eating something or potato chips, something.
Yeah.
That'd have been a good moment.
It would.
I'm sure there was a lot of jokes out there like that of just that's just stuff that got cut.
Yeah. Very good. Anything else you wanted to say or?
I miss John Candy.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
It's hard to like watch his movies a little bit because you're just sort of like, man, way too
did
soon.
Did this make you want to throw in like Uncle Buck and?
Oh yeah. Yeah, Uncle Buck. Even like his scenes in Home Alone, like the three he has, he's great in those.
Or even Vacation when he shows up at the end at the amusement park.
Or Who is Harry Crumb? You ever see that one?
I want to say yes. I think I must have watched it once.
It's one of those like Man Who Knew Too Littles. Yeah. He's like the bumbling detective.
I was going to say he's like a private eye, isn't he?
Right, but he's like the worst private eye, and yet it all works out for him.
Yeah, I think I saw that once many moons ago.
That's a funny movie. It's funny because of him. If it was anyone else, you'd be like, this movie doesn't work. But because it's John Candy, it works.
All right. Well, thanks, everyone, for listening. Matt, thanks for watching the film, and I'm glad you enjoyed it. Brought happy tears to my eyes.
Yeah.
Even sitting here talking about it. Appreciate everyone for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. Your thoughts on this film or Throw Mama from a Train or any other John Candy or Steve Martin films for that matter, anything you want to throw at us, go ahead and send it to timeshifterspodcast@gmail.com. Tweet at us @timeshifterspod and @moviesatthemat. Let us know the four films that define you. And if you're going to send it in by an email or something, give us a little explanation as to why those films, you know, what they mean to you or mean for you. That would be awesome. So we'll be back in a couple weeks. Until then, thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you later. Bye.
Welcome to Marathon. May I help you?
Yes.
How may I help you?
You can start by wiping that f***ing dumbass smile off your rosy f***ing cheeks. Then you can give me a f***ing automobile, a f***ing Datsun, a f***ing Toyota, a f***ing Mustang, a f***ing Buick, four f***ing wheels and a seat.
I really don't care for the way you're speaking to me.
And I really don't care for the way your company left me in the middle of f***ing nowhere with f***ing keys to a f***ing car that isn't f***ing there. And I really didn't care to f***ing walk down a f***ing highway and across a f***ing runway to get back here to have you smile at my f***ing face. I want a f***ing car right f***ing now.
May I see your rental agreement?
I threw it away.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy, what?
You're f***ed.